This is Colourful Radio.
A bit of a celebrity stardust in the studio. Very pleased to say the actor David Harewood is here. David, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I'm just looking at some reviews here from the Telegraph.
I'm very bleary-eyed. I apologise to the listeners.
You're forgiven.
Luckily, he cannot be seen. We don't have a webcam yet, but we're still planning on it for moments like this, David. But in the Telegraph, nothing short of a triumph. Sometimes a play comes out of the blue and knocks everyone for six. It is a beautiful and startling piece, a play that keeps you marvelling to the end. The Independent, breathtaking, hilarious and heart-stopping. Both of them five stars. How do you feel, David Harewood, playing Martin Luther King in The Mountaintop?
Well, first of all, let me just say it's a fantastic play.
Yeah.
We're really lucky to have Katori Hall actually with us at the moment. She's actually in the country.
Ah.
She's going to be with us for another week, and I think she's just written a really wonderful, lively, funny, irreverent piece, and shows us a view, a sight of Martin Luther King that we're not really used to. And it's something that I took a little bit of getting used to from reading the script, but when I started to do the research, I began to see that the man, as well as being, you know, obviously an icon, but he wasn't without his faults.
He was a man of the flesh.
He was he was weak. His spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak.
Yes. Did you know about that kind of thing personally?
Absolutely. He talks about that. He basically says that, you know, we are creatures of duality. You know, we have good and we have bad. We have light and we have dark, and you can't have one without the other. And he was often, you know, seduced by the darker side, but he also managed to kind of, you know, do some amazing things as well. So what we try and give people is a rounded view of a man, a human being, rather than just presenting the icon,
because that's what I presume, like everybody else, you had grown to know and I suppose love the idea of this man. He was kind of quite saintly, and he essentially went willing like a lamb to the slaughter. You know, the night before he died, I may not get there with you, but we as a people, etc.
Yeah. Have you actually seen the play?
I haven't, but I'm
come
going to
see
now
the
that
play,
it's been transferred.
It's really powerful. And it starts with the mountaintop speech, where he prophetically talks about not being able to get there with you. And the very next day he was assassinated. And so the play is set the night before his assassination, just after he makes the mountaintop speech.
Is it at the Lorraine Motel?
At the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. And it's very funny, and it's very quite moving. And it's often, you know, you look out at the curtain call, you see people in tears, and it really, really touches people. You know?
I haven't seen the play myself yet, but our cultural critic Lindsay Johns has, and he was absolutely gushing about your performance and that of your co-star.
Oh, she's fantastic. Lorraine Burrows is absolutely wonderful. Really wonderful.
I mean, he was really, really, I mean, and about the writing, he just was like five stars all the way, and telling all our listeners to mobilise and go and see you guys down when you was in Battersea. Of course, now you've transferred to the West End, and I heard it's one of the quickest transfers ever.
The fastest ever transfer, West End transfer.
Brilliant. Fantastic. And how's it going in terms of audience numbers now you're in the West End?
It's going very well, but you know, the ticket prices are a lot more expensive. But it's nice to look out and see a very diverse audience. I have to say that. And it's very rare that you go to the theatre and see blacks, Asians, whites. I mean, all ages as well. Young children. It's wonderful. It's a very diverse crowd.
Fantastic. People are used to seeing.
And I have to say that, you know, I have to say to the people of colour, the play starts 8 o'clock, not
please don't
10
tell.
Past eight.
Please don't tell me the stereotypical things have been happening.
They come in like 20 people will walk in after about 15 minutes.
Oh, no.
Right during one of my phone calls.
And do you tut-tut from the stage? Because apparently some of the actors have been tut-tutting and saying, turn off that mobile phone. Apparently the actors are fighting back at the moment.
Oh,
you know, people are kind of messing up in the theatre.
Talking about getting security guards as well, aren't they, for bad behaviour?
I don't know
if they're going to deal with
hecklers.
With latecomers.
So tell us a bit more about, you know, where you are at this moment in your career, because obviously I've been watching you for years on television.
Listen.
I've seen you in film. No, no. Many, many years. I even announced to the audience about an hour or so ago, you're 2 years older than me, so they know how old you are. Anyway, let's move on from that. Yeah, you are.
Sorry about that.
You look it today.
Oh, yeah, you do. Look, 10 years older than me today.
He's tired, bless him.
But people will have seen you in so many things. Doing comedy as well, actually, in Little Miss Jocelyn, as some kind of bad Nigerian man who is cuckolded. Is that right?
That's right.
Mister, yeah. Is it? Oh, whoa, whoa, I can't do the name. Can you do it?
I think only she can do that.
So he's seen you in that. He did very, very well in Mastermind as well, called Celebrity Mastermind.
Did
you tie with a hairy biker?
With a hairy biker, and I should have won it, really. But I flew in especially just for that thing, and I was kind of thinking about getting my last plane home, so I haven't excused it yet.
All right, okay. And you were a bad man in Blood Diamond.
That's right, yeah.
Opposite DiCaprio. Mm-hmm. And recently you've been a big fat fryer. Well, you weren't that fat. You were kind of the most muscular fryer took I've ever seen.
I was a fit fryer.
Now, what was it like to get that call up? I mean, that must have hit you for six. Like, what? Me, fryer took?
It was a challenge, you know. Mm. I thought, you know, it was like, okay, this has never been done before, and it was an exciting direction, whether they wanted to take the character, make him more of a kind of warrior priest, and I kind of really kind of got onto that, and I suggested lots of martial arts moves and you know, the way I did my hair, and I mean everything. It was just they really liked it, and people, I get lots of fan mail. I've never had fan mail before. Lots of fan mail saying, yeah, we really, really liked it. So,
but we heard there was a bit of a backlash. Is that true, or is that just hype that people weren't happy with a black fryer tuck, or saying that it wouldn't have been possible?
Oh, there was lots of academics, but, you know, thank God
academics
don't run the world. You know? I think there was a little bit of hoo-ha, but really, I mean, when I took my daughters to school a couple of weeks ago, and I walked into the playground. You forget, you know. You don't walk around thinking that I'm fried on the telly. You forget. And I walked into the playground, and the kids went nuts. I mean, talking about black kids, white kids, Asian kids, Spanish kids, Portuguese kids. They just went nuts. And that's really what's important. Not what academics thing. 59-million-year-old academics. I don't really give a damn.
Got a text here from Katie in Hendon who says, can you ask David if he finds it daunting as an actor to take on parts of heroes like Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela? I've admired his work for years and will definitely be going to see him in the Mountaintop before the run is done. That's from Katie in Hendon. Do you find it daunting?
I did find Mandela daunting initially, because, you know, how do you play a myth? How do you play a kind of such an icon? But once you start to research, once you start to read, you start to find that he's just a man.
Yeah.
And then you start to find the vulnerabilities of the man and the characteristics of the man, and before you know it, you're actually just playing regular things. Because although we like to make heroes of our icons, leaders, they're just men. Mm-hmm. And same with Obama. Everyone, you know, Obama was swept into power on this kind of huge wave of public, his status was just out of this world.
But
he's just a man, and he'll mess up like every other man.
Yeah. Know? Like, what do you mean, like every other man? Some of us are good.
Apart from you, Henry, of course.
Thank you very much. And this is from Nadine, who says, good morning, Juju and Bonsu. I fancy David since Baby Father. Can you ask him if he'll be doing any more TV dramas with an all-black cast? Been a long time. That's Nadine.
It has been a long time. But, you know, Nadine, unfortunately, the most vocal critics of Baby Father were black people.
Yes, I know.
And they were responsible, you know, we were responsible for getting it taken off. Which is
really? Is that what that's, is that? Is that true, really?
Yeah.
I have heard this said before. Yeah.
Lots of complaints, and it wasn't black enough, and stereotypical, and, you know, you just... Unfortunately, those things are going to keep us in the dark ages, and we have to start looking forward and being a lot more creative and a little bit just less caught up with ourselves.
Does that really do your head in when, you know, you're in something, you're trying to play a character who's rounded, warts and all, and then people turn around and say, oh, it's not this enough, it's not that enough, things they would probably never say if it were just a general mainstream drama or play?
I don't know about in general, but it did annoy me with reference to Baby Father, because we had an all-black cast, we had black director, black first director, black sound man, black caterers. We had, I mean, you look around and everybody was black and they said it wasn't black enough.
Yeah.
And you know, we're all trying to pay our rent, we're all trying to pay the mortgage, you know, we're trying to get a job and this, you know, and also to, I think it was one of the best all-black dramas of its time, of its type at the time, and way ahead of its time. And, you know, maybe it started a bit slowly, but, you know, we would have got stronger.
Yeah.
Okay, we've gone back. Let's take it back a bit further in terms of how you started out in your career. I know you was brought up in Birmingham to Bajan parents.
You'd never tell, would you?
You'd never tell
there's
now.
There's no kind of Birmingham accent there.
No. I've actually met you.
I'm worried about this. Did I do anything unsavoury?
You didn't, no. You had a dance with my cousin. I don't know if I could call it a crub, but you know, it was a dance. My other friend kind of got off with Gary McDonald. This was in Barbados in the boatyard.
Oh, right.
many years ago.
Yes.
Yeah, so I saw you.
Is this for public consumption? Are you sure about this?
Oh, yeah. Okay, I mean, It was only fun. I mean, my friend fancied Gary McDonald for years, and you two guys walked into the boatyard where you don't really expect to see faces in that sense.
Oh, the boatyard's great.
Fantastic. And I know Gary, so we were talking. And my friend sort of said, you know, I've fancied Gary for years. You know, he's got them lips. I've been due to kiss those lips for years.
it's only 10 o'clock in the morning.
And you know Gary as well, David. So Gary being Gary was like, well, come then. And so gave her a kiss. And this kiss kind of lasted for about 2 minutes, which was very, very funny. Made her holiday. But yeah, you're...
right, moving swiftly on.
Your parents are Bajan.
Yes,
and yeah, acting. How did it come about?
I was always a kind of classroom clown, teachers used to just said, you know, what are you going to do when you leave? I was very lucky that they spotted something in me. I didn't really know what I was going to do, and they were very adamant that I should pursue a career on the stage. So I went home and told my parents, and they said, "What?
Yes, of course." They wanted you to be an accountant.
Of course. Yes, yeah. So there was a bit of a shock and a bit of surprise, but it seems to have worked out. Very lucky.
And you made the trip down the M6 or the M1 or whatever, and you ended up going to RADA.
That's right, yes.
Now, what was that like back in 19, whatever it was, 80-something? 70-something?
You know, I don't really come from the 80s. I don't really come from a very literary background. You know, I'm very fortunate that... I think I have what you call the confidence of ignorance.
Okay.
When I went to RADA, I'd read about three plays in my whole life.
Yeah.
I didn't really know much about Shakespeare or iambic pentameter or Pinter or all these, you know. I can remember sitting there on my first day and they were all talking about Dostoevsky and Moliere and Brecht.
Yes.
And I thought, who the bloody hell are they?
You were 18, wasn't you?
I had no idea. I was 18, yeah.
Was that considered quite young then for RADA? Or was there lots of 18-year-olds?
No, I think there were one or two 18-year-olds, okay. Yeah. But as I said, I didn't really know anything, and I was very fortunate that I think they picked me on just raw talent.
You were cocky,
I was kind of confident, and willing to experiment. And I've never really been afraid of anything like that. My first part was playing King Lear, and that's a huge Shakespeare, one of the biggest Shakespearean roles. And I thought, yeah, I'll have a go at that, and did that. I've played a lot of big Shakespearean characters, and I'd never really been daunted by any of them, really.
Did you have any sense of how big it was to get into RADA back then?
Yeah, very. You know, it's probably reputed to be one of the best drama schools. So I knew I was in a very fortunate position, and I was just very lucky to be surrounded by very talented people. And it's kind of, as I say, it's kind of worked out, really.
Right, we've got David Harewood in the studio. He's an actor. You'll have seen him in lots and lots of television drama and in films like Blood Diamond. Currently playing the part of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in The Mountaintop. It's on at the Trafalgar Studios for a number of weeks this summer. He's playing to rave reviews. Critics absolutely love him. And we love him here at Colourful. He's going to be with us in the studio for the next 20 minutes, half an hour or so. You can talk to him. You're happy to take a call or two, aren't you, David?
Yeah, go ahead.
Let's see if people want to talk to you. Here's the number, 0800-999-8090. That's 0800-999-8090. It's not Soon Come Productions. It's right now. It's Colourful. So you need to call immediately.
Or, of course, you can text us 80818. That's 80818. Start your text with the word Colourful, a space, and then your message or your question to David. Or, of course, you can go to the website colourfulradio.com and click on Email Me.
And David is prepared to take any kinds of questions, whether you're in the boat, yard in Barbados, or used to hang out with him in the West Midlands, or in the Black Country, whatever he used to do. You can embarrass him right here on Colourful, but at the same time you can also praise him. to the nth degree because he loves praise. You can see that in his face. He's smiling. He's been a baddie. He's been a blood diamond smuggler. He's been a murderer. He's also been a hero. He's been a swords wielding.
I'm going to come here again, actually. Yeah. I quite like this.
This is Colourful Radio.
David Hayward is with us until about 5 minutes to 10. Is that okay, David? You happy with that?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
All right. Something that I've wanted to ask you about on air for a bit is your philanthropic nature. I don't know if you're naturally like that, but you did help to save somebody's life a couple of years ago, and we shouldn't kind of hide our light under a bushel. Most of us, hopefully, if called, would do it, but actually, I'm not really sure. What actually happened in your case, and how did you manage to save somebody's life?
It was part of the ACLT, you know, the Afro-Caribbean Leukemia Trust. Yeah. I used to go down and support Daniel and Orin. Orin and Beverly DeGale at their yearly functions, and I suddenly realised that although I'd been kind of guessed at their dinners, I hadn't actually put myself on the register.
And you say that slightly humbly and modestly because, what did you feel embarrassed that I'm coming to this event and I haven't put myself forward?
Or was it somebody said kind of, I just hadn't thought about it. I thought I was helping by
being
turning
there.
Up. And then you kind of realize, hang on a minute. It was my girlfriend. My girlfriend said, we were at the carnival one year and she said, are you actually on the register?
Yeah.
I said, yeah, sure I am. Of course I am. And she said, no, have you actually given blood? Yeah. And I suddenly realized that I hadn't. So it was actually Beverly who put the needle in my arm, actually, and took the sample. And then literally 2 years later, I got a letter through saying that I was a match for somebody, which was really very moving experience when you kind of realise that you could be the one person that could save a complete stranger's life.
Was it moving and also maybe slightly frightening, daunting?
Not at all, no, because, you know, you just put yourself in the other person's position.
Yeah.
And that's what I kind of did, which was to think that they were very, very ill and they possibly had children or possibly was, you know, obviously somebody's son or somebody's father, or, you know, I put myself in their position and I thought, well, if I needed help and there was one person on this planet that I could turn to, I would hope that they would kind of step forward. And, and so I just did, and I had a week of kind of stem cell stimulation injections, and then and then just went for the procedure.
And how much information did you get about it, and especially afterwards?
I'll be honest with you, Henry, I didn't care. Yeah. I didn't even ask them what I was being injected with. All I was concerned with was what I needed to do to help this person out. And luckily, the person has pulled through, and I'm just very happy that I managed to save somebody's life.
How does it compare to acting, the satisfaction you get from doing that?
Oh, that's real. I mean, that is real. I mean, what we do is, it's wonderful, and you know, I get a great buzz from it, but that's something that is very real and tangible and much more, therefore, emotional, I think.
Absolutely.
Something else that other people might not know about you, David, we were talking a bit about it off air, you could have actually been a professional goalkeeper, I believe. You had real, real talent in that area.
I'm not sure whether I could have been a professional because I just didn't have the heart for it, man. I mean, as soon as it rained, I was like, let's call, this. call this thing off, let's get back in.
This is terrible. This reminds me of that comment by Ron Knowles, who used to be chairman of... you know the quote?
I remember, yes.
He says, you know, the black players are good, you know, when we're going forward and the sun is shining, we're winning 1-0. But during the winter months, you need the hard white man to carry you through. He was thinking about you, was he?
No, I was a goalkeeper I played in some pretty successful teams, so I didn't really have much to do. So I found myself standing around
freezing,
doing very little. So
oh, that's terrible.
Tip for Ron Knowles.
And what about other aspects of David Harewood? I mean, you put yourself, body and soul, I would imagine, into some of the roles you play, and you have to travel.
Yeah.
You have played Sierra Leonean blood diamond smuggler and murderer. And also, you're playing Nelson Mandela in a BBC film to be shown, I think, later this year, opposite Sophie Okonodo. I think it's called Mrs. Mandela. That's right, isn't it? What was it like going to South Africa and steeping yourself in the world of Mandela and the world of the anti-apartheid movement?
I have to say, it's always very inspiring. I've been very fortunate to go to Africa on two or three different occasions. To work, and each time I go, I kind of come back with a real sense of myself as a person, my identity is kind of confirmed. It's hard to explain, but when you're actually in a country where the majority of the people are black,
yeah,
your back starts to straighten, your head starts to come up, and before you realize it, you know, you're kind of thinking, yeah, this is how it should be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking around, everybody's black, you know, bus driver, bank manager's black, everyone's black, and you kind of, your eyes start to open, and you start to really kind of flower, I think. And as I say, politically, I've kind of studied the kind of emancipation of the whole black race, and from, as I say, Mandela through to now to King, and you can't help but feel kind of inspired by it. And also, just looking at the people of Africa, and especially when I was in Mozambique, some very poor people, very poor country, but people are incredibly generous, and I find that almost the poorer the people, the more generous they are. It's always inspiring to be there, but when you come back, you suddenly realize actually our kids don't really know that they're alive, man. They're really quite lucky.
It's interesting hearing this from you, because you don't strike me as a kind of person who during their day-to-day existence in the UK, in London, whatever, goes around thinking, I'm a black man, I'm under pressure, I'm a black man, it's the enemy out to get me. You seem to strike me as a kind of guy who's got fairly broad shoulders and you know has been pretty successful in life and just takes it as it comes. But when you went to the continent, you kind of felt.
It's hard to put it into words. But I mean, as I said, I spent like a month in South Africa playing Mandela, being Mandela every day, and it was amazing.
Did you go around actually speaking Sele? Very nice to see you.
Oh, like very, very much. But it was really inspiring, and I have to say, coming home, I had this really strange feeling when I got on the plane on the way back. I suddenly thought, I'm the only black person on this plane.
Yeah.
Where am I going?
That was in first class.
It was. I was like, where am I going? And for the first time, it really spanned my head. And I really couldn't get my head back into being me for at least about 3 or 4 weeks. I found that very difficult. I never experienced that before. But I really struggled to kind of get my head back into being a minority.
Right.
I think that's probably my only shout out to what you were saying.
Yeah.
Was that you suddenly start thinking, oh, well, you know, you walk out in the street and you're not part of that majority.
Yeah.
And I saw a lot of kind of black empowerment, even in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
People say Johannesburg is the kind of crime capital of the world, but I found it tremendously inspiring to see.
What kind of things did people say to you? Did they know who you were? A lot of people.
Some people do. It's really interesting when you're walking down the street in Johannesburg and somebody shouts out, baby father!
You're thinking someone's going to come running up with you, running up with a little baby saying, remember the time?
remember me?
Remember me? But it wasn't about that. It was people had watched the BBC drama, basically.
Yeah, and it's worldwide. They kind of say, well, when's it coming back? When's it coming back? We love it. And again, here we are on our kind of little pedestal and trying to say that this isn't black enough, that isn't good enough, this isn't what it's really like. Mm. People absolutely loved it around the world.
Yeah.
Really did.
Could you ever see yourself living in Africa or the Caribbean one day?
I'd love to, I mean, I think Africa is going through a pretty parts of Africa are going through pretty turbulent times, but I would like to think it's going to come through and that it's only just freeing itself from its kind of colonial past. And some, you know, kind of tin pot dictators, but I'm very inspired when I'm there. I'm very inspired by it, and it's beautiful. You know, the climate, the culture, the weather, and I think people are incredibly politicized there.
Yes,
we would be doing some scenes, and all these extras, 50 extras, would all suddenly break out singing. Break out singing freedom songs, and all harmonize. They all know it. They all know it's part of their blood. It's part of their makeup. Politics and being who they are is part of their makeup, and I found that really inspiring.
And were you able to join in?
No.
Or did you stand there like a British man going,
exactly.
This is really good. I'm so British.
But it's really, I went to church. I was taken to church by this rather beautiful lady.
Careful.
Yeah, no, but we kind of met eyes and we got talking in a restaurant, and she took me to church on the Sunday, and I stood in this church on the Sunday morning, just surrounded by black faces, and I started weeping.
What?
I found it really moving. Here I was in the middle of nowhere, no one knew who I was, and they were all welcoming, and then they asked me to speak and introduce myself, and I said, yeah, I'm here, David Harewood, I'm playing Mandela, and then they said, oh, tell me a bit about yourself, and before I knew it, I was like, oh, I felt really moved, and I thought, here I am, you know, a black man from England, which they couldn't understand, a black Englishman.
Yeah.
They just couldn't understand the concept of a black Englishman.
Mm-hmm.
Here I am, a black Englishman in Africa, playing an African,
yes.
feeling like I'm really at home,
yes.
and wondering where the hell I do live. And it was a kind of moving moment, and tears started rolling down, and everyone else started coming, laying hands on me and praying for me, and it was really beautiful. Sun was out. It was a beautiful moment. I wept like a baby, and then they all kind of just smiled, and I felt really happy for the rest of the day, really, really happy, and bright and part of something, you know.
This is the kind of thing you don't see when, you know, those BBC or Channel 4 documentaries place like a black Brit in an African country, you know. Mm. You don't see what you've just described to us. You just don't really see that. You know, you see these fake things. You see these guys saying, I'm from Essex. What's his African mumbo jumbo? You see all this foolishness, because there's been a few programs like that. But I wish, even though it would have been slightly intrusive, a camera had been trained on you. Mm. People could have seen that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe there's would have really meant those kind of programs because I often think that when I'm traveling, you know, that people don't see the kind of Africa. You know, a lot of British people think that Africa is this kind of mess of a country.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's starving. And that's why I had real problems with Comic Relief this year or last year, wherever it was, because that wasn't the Africa that I saw. I didn't see starving, thousands of starving people die lying in the street. You see a very prosperous, very happy, you know, I'm not saying that they're all like that, but...
Yeah, there's poverty.
But I found it really inspiring, and a lot of things I came across were very inspiring to me.
This is Colourful Radio.